There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Good afternoon, I'm Helen Farmer and this is Dubai Today. It is the holy month of Ramadan, which sees Muslims across the world give up food and drink from dawn to sunset. But Ramadan isn't just about fasting. It is a time of deep spiritual reflection and self-improvement. A large part of this is the act of helping those who are less fortunate, and many Muslims spend the month of Ramadan giving up their time and money to help people in many, many ways. To mark the holy month, I spoke to four different organisations to learn about the work they do to help improve the lives of others. So Dr. Siku is the Fred Hollows Foundation's Medical Advisor for Africa and Director of the Rwanda International Institute of Ophthalmology. The Foundation is an international development organisation founded in Australia, working with more than 25 countries to end avoidable blindness. Around the world, it has restored sight to more than 2.5 million people, and it performs more than 1 million eye operations and treatments every year. In late 2017, a regional office was opened in the International Humanitarian City in Dubai to support people across the Middle East and Africa. I'm joined on the line by Dr. Siku. Now, I understand you're in Rwanda at the moment. Can you tell me a little bit about the work that you're doing there, please, Doctor?
Yes, so I work as an ophthalmologist in a large eye hospital in Rwanda, and the Fred Hollows Foundation has a big community project in Rwanda. My day-to-day job is to treat patients in the hospital. At the same time, I provide the medical advice that that program needs, so dealing with making sure that the quality of treatment is correct, that the right equipment is being bought for the hospitals that the foundation supports. That's the role I play for the foundation.
So operations as well as treating people every day as well. And what kind of conditions are people coming into the hospital with, Doctor?
So the leading cause of blindness in Rwanda, as in many developing countries, is cataract. So most of the patients walking in are blind from cataract. And the sad thing is that no one needs to be blind from cataract because it's a completely reversible condition. But in places like Rwanda, people usually wait a long time with the cataract until they lose sight. And that's because some of them don't know that there's a treatment for it. Others know, but they have no access to services, and also the eye doctors are just so few, so it takes a long time to have help.
I'm reading up on this issue. I was really shocked to find out that 4 out of 5 people who are blind actually don't need to be, and that's for some of the reasons you've just mentioned there in terms of waiting too long and not having the access to that medical help and equipment. The issue seems to be growing as well. You know, sources indicate blindness is expected to triple by 2050. Why is this, and what do you think we can do about it, Doctor?
A lot of the conditions that blind people are age-related. So as the world gets older, people are living longer, so there will be a higher number of old people. And even in places like Rwanda, we've seen the life expectancy increase a lot in the last 10 years. Mm-hmm. So there'll just be a lot more human beings alive to have eye problems. But also some new conditions are emerging that are becoming a real problem. An example is the eye complications of diabetes.
Oh, really?
In Africa, for example, diabetes never used to be such a big problem, but it is becoming a big problem. And
why do you think diabetes is on the rise?
I think it's change in lifestyle and just, you know, more sedentary lifestyle, change in diet, change from the normal African way of life.
Mm-hmm.
So there's lots more there now.
So how does the Fred Hollows Foundation go about its work? You know, what procedures do you focus on?
Okay, so the foundation doesn't just treat eyes. It's a development organization, and therefore the approach also aims to change the whole eye health system rather than just treating individual patients. For example, in Rwanda, when we started with a survey of blindness, trying to understand what is the need in the country, mm-hmm. what diseases are we dealing with. And that survey was extremely useful. So that's a bit of research. After that, we then realized that human resource was a big problem here. So the foundation invests a lot in training people, not just doctors, but also the people who support the doctors, so training the eye team. And after training people, then they need the places to work. So the foundation also supports the building of eye units, equipping them, So it's the whole spectrum before you reach the actual disease treatment.
And how do you manage to operate on such a large scale geographically? You know, we've set up a regional office here in Dubai, but you're doing work all over Africa. And obviously there's Australian connection as well. So it's literally an international project. It must be a huge amount going on behind the scenes before a patient even walks into a clinic. What are the challenges faced there in terms of working geographically across the world?
The foundation has expanded to about 26 countries just because the need is so great. I remember at the beginning years, the foundation talking work maybe in two countries in Africa, two countries in Asia. But as you get to the field, you realize the need is so much, and there's all these countries saying, can you also help us? So that has led the need for the expansion. And I guess that is why the office in Dubai is so important, because it provides a link between this region of Africa and also the Middle East, where we support Palestine, Pakistan. So it's the expansion is driven by the need, and as we expand to more countries, then our needs as an organization also increase, and we have different needs in different countries, so there's no one formula for each country.
So tell me more about the work you're doing in this region. Are there any specific challenges or concerns when it comes to preventing and treating blindness in the Middle East?
In the Middle East, I can talk about Palestine, where we have a small program. The levels of blindness in Palestine are higher than even some of the developing countries, and there's a real shortage of eye health workers there. So the need is great, the people to provide the treatment are few. Therefore, the foundation is trying to support training of doctors, providing materials that are needed for the training, that sort of thing.
I mean, a restoring sight has such a great impact on an individual and their work and their employment prospects. What are some of the broader kind of economic and societal benefits to restoring blindness and the work that the foundation is doing?
Some of the conditions, like, say, the complications of diabetes, are affecting people who are in the working age group. But just by preventing that blindness or restoring sight for those who are already blind, you put somebody back in the workforce and they're able to support their family. In places like Africa, where we are dealing mainly with cataracts in the older people, This has an impact on children in the family. So usually you'll find that when a grandmother goes blind, one of the children is identified as a caregiver for that grandmother or grandfather, and therefore that child drops out of school. And once we restore sight to that grandmother or grandfather, that child is released and can have an education and have a more productive life.
Fantastic work that the foundation is doing. How can people get involved, Dr. Siku? How can we donate or find out more?
So the Fred Hollows website will give a lot of information about where we work and what the different programs are doing. There are many, many avenues for support. You can support training of doctors. You can support buying of equipment. You can support direct patient treatment. So there are people who like to say, I want to support this particular patient, and I want to know what happens after they regain their sight. You can support the health system interventions that are needed. There is really a lot of avenues that one can support, and the need is great at the foundation level. The need is great at the country level.
Dr. Siku Makande, thank you so much for joining us on Dubai Today. I'm wishing you all the best with the great work that you're doing.
Stay one step ahead with Dubai Eye.
Download the IRN News Centre app now.
I spoke to Maureen Hall, the founder, designer and CEO of UAE-grown swimsuit company Kuega. Kuega has grown dramatically over the last decade and a half, now manufacturing thousands of items daily in Dubai. When Maureen discovered in 2011 that a new law required proper swimwear to be worn on local beaches and that labourers would be affected if they could not afford the swimwear, she launched the Drop Your Shorts campaign to make sure those less fortunate can enjoy the beach on their day off. So you moved to Dubai 18 years ago and set up Kuega. What was it that you recognised in the Dubai market that you felt needed a little bit of help from you?
Well, myself and my family, we burn quite easily in the sun. And as Dubai is a place where you spend a lot of hours at the beach and at the pool with your family, I decided to make some UV swimwear for myself and my boys. And when we were at the pool and beach, everybody would be like, "Wow, that's really nice. You guys are the best dressed family at the pool." And so I was like,
take that compliment. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
And so how did it grow then from just creating swimwear for you and your family to turning it into a business? It's a big step to take.
Big step. I started looking at sourcing fabric, where to buy some fabric to bring in bulk, and then looking for a contract manufacturer in Jebel Ali. So I just went out and I just started making phone calls, looking in the yellow pages and that sort of thing. Because the computer wasn't, there was a bit on the web back then, but not so much. Designed everything, brought the fabric in, like I said, and then went around to some of the smaller stores to see if they would stock it. My first store was actually Park and Shop on Elwha Road. Yeah, we started with the little pool shoes. I made these, that was one of the first things that went to market, was these little no-slip heat-resistant pool shoes, because I would watch all these small children burning their feet on the hot stones, or slipping when the pavers around the pool and that would get wet, and I was like, oh gosh, I don't want my kids doing that. So,
and it's grown now from pool shoes and some swim shorts. Now you're doing sportswear. You've got modest swimwear, hats, all sorts. So really big range.
Shorts, the things. I like to include everybody, and the idea is Coega is UV swimwear for everybody.
Tell us about the initiative of Drop Your Shorts. You first launched it in 2011, I believe. What needed you recognize there, the way you felt that you could help?
Well, I read in 7 days one morning that there was going to be a new law that the municipality said that proper swimwear must be worn on the beaches. Mm-hmm. And one of the groups that would be affected would be some of the laborers. And I thought, oh, that seems rather unfair, to go out and buy a pair of swim shorts just to go to the beach. That's a bit of a luxury for them. Mm-hmm. And then, in school, doing the school run, I was in the car, and on Dubai 92, they were talking about this article that was on the front page of 7 days. And they were like, somebody really needs to start an initiative and start a campaign. And I was thinking to myself, they're right. Somebody should start an initiative. And, it really should be Coega, because we make swimwear and we are in Dubai and we can help out. First of all, I thought it would be good, like we could donate some of our swimwear ourselves, because obviously we make swimwear. So, but then I thought, how can we get the community involved? So I went to our customers who we sell our swimwear through, and I was like, can we put drop boxes? Maybe we can get the general public to donate new or, fairly new, clean swim shorts at different stores throughout different malls. But the malls would not give the approval for that, because they said if, used clothing, it might not be clean for sanitary purposes and that. So then I was like, okay, what about schools? So then I started approaching schools and went through, we had drop boxes at all the schools and community centers and that sort of thing.
And what was the response like in that first year?
The first year, we got a small response, to be honest. We had a hard time, The schools were on board, but when we went to pick up the stuff from the drop boxes, there would be like sometimes nothing in them, or one or two pairs or stuff like that. So it's like, okay, we need to come up with a new idea. How can this, what can we do? Because it was something I felt like, when you first give swim shorts to the guys and the smile on their face and they're just happy to receive this, it's like,
it means so much.
Yeah. So it's like, I want to keep doing this. It's a good initiative, but I'm not going to stop just because there's one roadblock, and I think that's probably true for most entrepreneurs. There's always a roadblock somewhere
at some point.
I'll find another way in.
So that first year you managed to donate a few pairs. Who did you give them to, and how did you choose which camps to go to?
We called up a labor camp. I'm not even sure now the first year how we got in touch with this labor camp. Yeah, we drove in our cars. We had to get permission. You have to get permission to go in. So we got the permission. I think we must have called the municipality or something. I mean, it was a bit of a long process the first year. Mm-hmm. And then we went in and we donated it, you know, the stuff that we had collected from the general public and the stuff that Cahuéga had made as well.
And how did the guys react?
I mean, they are just so appreciative. When you give them something and you see the big smile on their face and they say thank you, and it's just like, oh, that's so nice.
You've done something important.
Yeah. It's like, no, I should be thanking you.
But it's interesting. It's, you know, as you said, it's something that a lot of people would throw out or, you know, think nothing of, just putting in the back of the cupboard, and like many of us do, it just stays there until you move house or leave Dubai, and then it gets thrown out at some point down the line. But by donating a simple pair of swim shorts, what you're really doing is transforming someone's weekend, or allowing them to go somewhere at the weekend where they previously didn't feel welcome or didn't feel able to go. And that kind of quality of life is really, really meaningful. So after that first year, you just kept on going.
It kept on going. And then what we've done now in the last few years is we've linked up with Dubai Mums Helping Hands.
Yes, fantastic.
Because they have access to the labor camps and they move around to different labor camps. So what we do is when we are ready for our donation, we hook in with them and we say, okay, which labor camp are you going, you know, to? Can we come with you? And they organize. It's very well organized. So we all meet at like Times Square at 7 in the morning, and we load up the bus. And it's not just us, like Dubai Mums Helping Hands. They have other volunteers that come in and donate food or clothing or toiletry items or anything like that. So, and they kind of move around from compound to labor camp to labor camp. We all meet at Times Square. There's a bus that's organized, and SAFA Community School sponsored the bus this year.
And how many pairs were donated this year?
This year we did 400.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, we knew there were 400 men.
Yes, you got a
goal. Sometimes we do women's camps as well.
Fantastic.
So this was, we knew there was 400, so whatever we could pull in from, and what we've also started doing is the customers that we sell the Cahuéga brand at, we ask them, listen, do you have anything end of line or, you know, that you would like to donate end of season for swim shorts? Not just our brand, but maybe other brands of swimwear that they have. So we collect those as well. And then whatever is missing from the 400 or however many men there are, we make sure to top that up.
And big smiles on the day.
Yeah.
So, and also you chose to do the donation day during Ramadan this year, which I think is especially meaningful. And you're hoping to continue this for years to come, Maureen?
Yes. We've been doing it for now. This was our seventh year. And I have no thoughts about stopping it. We will continue to do it. I think it's a worthwhile cause.
Well, keep us posted in terms of donations through the year and for that big donation day when you've got enough pairs, just onwards and upwards. Maureen, thank you so much for joining us on Dubai Today, and all the very best with Drop Your Shorts in years to come.
Great. Thank you so much.
Stay one step ahead with Dubai Eye.
Download the IRN News Centre app now.
The UNHCR is the United Nations refugee agency dedicated to helping refugees and displaced people all over the world. Over 28,000 people a day are forced to flee their homes, with over 65 million people having been displaced globally. Hussein Shahim is the Senior Private Sector Partnerships Officer and overlooks the private sector partnerships for the UNHCR in the whole MENA region. I speak to him about his work.
So tell me about you, Sham. How long have you been working with the UNHCR?
Actually, I've been working with UNHCR for the last 6 years or even a little bit more. We are a very active organization when it comes to the protection of refugees. It starts from registering refugees when they flee a conflict zone, and then we make sure that they are protected legally. At the same time, we provide for them humanitarian assistance. And we try to get them back, of course, to their countries of origin when everything is okay, or we try to move them somewhere else where other countries will welcome them, or they are integrated more and more where they are. So we try to find sustainable solutions for refugees and internally displaced people all around the world.
Let's talk about the refugee camps. I know there's one in particular that you've been working with. Have you been on any missions to that camp recently?
Yes, of course. I mean, just to highlight that most of refugees, more than 80% of refugees, are usually outside camps, right? Mm-hmm. So mainly refugees are in urban situations. But of course, when it comes to camps, it's really more famous because it's kind of more focused. So it's easier to reach there and see the refugees. Whether on the other side, when it comes to urban situations, for example, refugees in Lebanon, there are no official camps in Lebanon. More than a million refugees are there. But in Jordan, just another example, and going back to your question, you have two official camps that UNHCR is managing. It's really now it grew to be kind of a city, a small city.
How many people are there currently?
We're talking about 80,000 people.
Wow.
Around 80,000 people in that camp. And it grew really organically, and you have families, and you have schools, and you have so people are there for some time. Mm-hmm. With a lot of challenges, of course, because it's not easy to be sitting one place and waiting for the support that you need to have in the urban situation, where families as well are trying to cope with the cost of life, with where they cannot really work most of the time, or they cannot find jobs, but as well they try to get their children to education and at schools. And it's really, really hard. That's why this Ramadan we're trying to highlight the needs and the families who are mainly headed by women. A lot of men are usually left behind, or you know, for different reasons. So you have more than 50% are women, as when we talk about refugees, and 70% of the total numbers are women and children. So what we're trying to do is really highlight the need for these families to develop, of course, survive, develop, and sustain themselves. And this is what we're trying to do this Ramadan. The Zaatari camp, for example, really developed organically. So there wasn't a plan to have a camp, and then people were resided there, and because of the generosity of the Jordanian government, this developed very quickly, and there was a lot of support because a lot of donors, because of the number of refugees. So as I said, 70% in Jordan are outside the camp, so a lot of families are living in urban situations, and they are in need for immediate assistance and continuous assistance.
That's and when you say assistance, what do they need?
Yeah. So actually, there is, of course, historically, the humanitarian sector, international NGOs and NGOs were trying to provide in-kind solutions, kind of blankets, food, you know, the main things that you think refugees need every day.
Mm-hmm.
But the shift in the thinking now, as the humanitarian sector and UNHCR is providing more and more cash-based intervention, or what we call cash assistance. And this is really a monthly gift, in a way, to those refugees to make sure that they are surviving the month to month, find the minimum budget to send their children to school, cover the rent, health care, even buying food in some cases. We're kind of trying to change the mindset of giving people things, which, mm-hmm. you know, they might not need, to give them the freedom, and especially moms, to decide what is best for their families.
And this is running a household like they would have been running a household before, with a certain amount of money coming in and making budgetary decisions about what's needed for that family.
Exactly. And this is the new mindset, and we're trying to change this.
So how can people get involved?
First of all, Ramadan Kareem to all listeners. And what
and
we're
to
trying
you.
To do this Ramadan is really to have one strong voice. So we launched the campaign, which, you know, trying to focus on the needs we talked about just now, trying to say, you know, listen, we in Ramadan is the spirit of being together, the spirit of family, the spirit of eating together, the spirit of getting together. And those refugees, you know, they can be part of our family. The hashtag of the campaign is hand in hand, and the message is really we want to be together this Ramadan, and we don't want to leave anyone behind, including those people who are displaced and they have to leave their household, their houses, their countries, their villages.
And zakat is obviously one of the five main pillars of Islam. How does it work with UNCR collecting and distributing zakat from donors?
We just launched lately our zakat campaign, global zakat campaign, and we have a platform for that which is really trusted, efficient and compliant. Trusted because it's online, we know, and people will know where the money is going. In this case, on the zakat donation, 2.5% is going to the cash-based intervention program or the cash assistance program in both Jordan and Lebanon, and it's 100% going there. So all the zakat donation that people are giving, it's going directly to Jordan or Lebanon, to the 60,000 families who are in need for cash-based intervention continually, and I'm talking only about this year. If we don't have enough support for these families, unfortunately, by July, there might be a shortage in budget, and this is really, really important. And it's compliant with the fatwas and with the Sharia laws and regulations in this case.
I think that's a really important point, actually, because often people donate money and don't really know where it's going. It could be going to cover wages of employees at certain organisations. It could be covering operation costs. But everything that's donated, your zakat is going to somebody in need. It's going in their hand. What about beyond Ramadan? What does the future hold, do you think, for these refugees with the UNCR is working with?
It's really the future. Unfortunately, it's unknown, and we want to make sure that hand in hand, we are supporting those who are not privileged enough, as I am in this case, with my family and sitting having iftar around the table. What we want to make sure is we keep on thinking of them, because, you know, as the crisis is taking more and more time, and we don't know when it's going to end, we need to remember, and as a human, it's our duty to remind each other in a way. The future is unknown, but what is really known is that there is a duty somewhere, at least with us, that we would like to remind people that hand in hand we can make a difference, and we don't want to leave anybody behind. If at least we try to do that, there's a hope that at least the most vulnerable families will be assisted, and they will be hopefully having you know, a decent meal. They will have a decent education, and they will might have a chance to sustain themselves through some social activity. This is what we're aiming at. So I invite everyone to look at the hashtag hand in hand and decide how they would like to be engaged, whether it's being raised their voice, whether it's being spread the message, whether it's being, you know, giving a gift to those refugees directly or give their zakat. There are a lot of things we can do and a lot of options.
That's fantastic. Thank you so much for sharing exactly what we can be doing to help with the UNHCR this Ramadan. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Stay one step ahead with Dubai Eye.
Download the IRN News Centre app now.
Ramadan is a time of giving, of sharing with those less fortunate than ourselves. Something to eat and drink is the most basic of needs and an opportunity for us to donate and get involved. Started in 2016, the Ramadan Sharing Fridges are where community workers and labourers can visit to collect food to break their fast. Joining me on the line is Fikra, who started her own Ramadan fridge, which sparked the movement that now has 27,000 members on Facebook. Thank you for joining us, Fikra. How are you?
Thank you, Helen, for having me. I'm fine. Thank you. How are you?
Well, thank you. Huge commends and congratulations on really just the enormity of the Ramadan Sharing Fridges movement. It's just grown beyond all recognition. What prompted you to start your own fridge?
Yeah, so it was really, really simple. We just had a spare fridge and we thought, what are we going to do with it? You know what? Why not put it outside our house and fill it up for the workers? And we just fill it up with water and juices, stuff like that. And we thought it would be a really nice and simple way to teach our children the value of sharing and caring with those people around us. So we told them, we said, well, we have this fridge here. We're going to put it outside. And they were always like, we had a really, really sweet garden, and he would always come and we'd give him like drinks and food, and we always let the children do it, just, you know, to show them like it's important to look at the less fortunate, and he does so much for us, so we need to acknowledge him and give him some love. So we said, we're going to have the fridge now outside, and then we're going to fill it up, and it's for the workers. And they thought it was so nice and amazing. So they would stand next to the fridge and give out the waters. When we realized that it was something that they appreciated so much, and our fridge would be emptied within no time, and Ramadan was around the corner, we thought, you know what, let's involve the neighbors and ask them to help us fill the fridge, because it was quite hard for us to keep up. We made flyers, and the children, they went out and gave it to all the neighbors, and the response was amazing. People would come and fill it up and ring the doorbell and say, oh, this is such a great initiative, and I'm going to support you throughout the whole month. And it was really, really nice. It
sounds really heartwarming. And you're fasting yourself this Ramadan.
Yes, I am.
So you do truly understand the need of so many of these workers. So obviously completing one of the five pillars of Islam, you know, the zakat, but also the empathy of these guys who haven't got anywhere to go often for kind of food and nourishment.
It's the beauty of Ramadan, you know. That's the whole spirit of it, sharing and caring and coming together.
And then Samaya, who's an Australian expat, heard about your fridge, started her own, and that seemed to be when the movement really started to grow. What happened then?
Well, actually, she took over our fridge, because I was giving away my fridge after 2 years because we were moving and I could not have the fridge outside my house. So I asked whoever can take over my fridge. And then Sumaya said, yeah, I would love to take over your fridge and use it for the same purpose. And then she is the one who started the Facebook page, because there were so many people interested and asking her, like, where is the location? And she thought, well, if I have a Facebook page, it's going to be easier. People can come together and we can talk about it. And even if other people would like to set up, it's an easy way to do so. And that was in 2016. And from there, it went viral, actually.
It's huge, absolutely huge. As I said, 27,000 members now on that Facebook page. And I think it's turned into a bit of a full-time occupation during the Holy Month, maintaining that page and keeping the communication lines open, telling people how to start their own fridges, how to contribute to fridges. From a really practical basis, what do people need if they want to start their own Ramadan fridge? Apart from a fridge, of course, with power. What about signage, or what goes in the fridge?
We advise everyone to go to the Facebook page, which is Ramadan Sharing Fridges. Have a look on the location map, because at the moment we have close to 200 fridges around Dubai. So just make sure that there's not a fridge in your area, because we would like to ask people to team up if there is a fridge in the area, because it's really hard to keep up with filling the fridge. So we'd rather have one full fridge than, you know, two empty fridges, basically. Mm-hmm. If there's not a fridge around your area, you can send us a message on Facebook and we will lead you throughout the whole process.
And what kind of foods and drinks can people find when they open it?
Well, we have a list of all-time favorites. You can think of juices, milk, leban are very popular, biscuits, fruits and vegetables. Basically everything that is packed. So no cooked food or hot meals. These are not allowed.
Well, that makes a lot of sense in terms of health and safety and, you know, food safety as well.
Exactly, exactly.
And what do you think it is about these fridges that have really captured the imagination and the hearts of Dubai residents, Fikra?
Well, I really think that it's because it's bringing communities together. We are all people from different backgrounds, religions, cultures, and we all come from all over the world. And this is something that connects us. It's something so simple, something that everyone can do. Mm. And I think that's what makes it easy for everyone. The fact that it's in Ramadan, it's a month of sharing, makes it easier as well.
I've loved seeing the children getting involved, and it's something that I'm doing with my own children, buying things and buying extra for others. And it's such an easy thing we can communicate to our children, though. It really is.
Exactly. It's amazing. Like, I mean, this is also something that we like to tell everyone and encourage everyone to have their children involved as much as possible. Because it's such an amazing way of teaching them the concept of sharing and caring for the less fortunate. So, yeah, we would love to see as much children as possible. We're really happy to say that we are having over 20 schools involved.
Brilliant.
Which is, like, amazing. Yeah. And, it's really, really heartwarming to see that.
I think in Dubai, so many of us
want to do good. And often we just need our hands held a little bit and shown us how we can contribute something as seemingly simple as buying, you know, like an extra crate of water bottles or some extra crisps and biscuits. And it is such a simple thing. I've even seen some of the fridges being used as art canvases. Have you seen them on social media? Some that people have got really creative with how they're decorated.
Yes, we love that. It's really nice. So there are like really cool artists over there who wanted to paint some of the fridges.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in total it's like 35 fridges that have been painted by different artists. And it's
so
amazing.
Cool.
I mean, it gives some life and something extra to the fridges. And we're really happy about that.
And what do you think the future is going to hold? Is there scope for doing this year round, or is that perhaps just not feasible at the moment?
Of course, ideally, like in a perfect world, that would be amazing, right? To have those fridges running. But realistically, it's really, really hard, as I mentioned before, to keep those fridges full.
Mm-hmm.
It's honestly really difficult. Also, I think it's a success and it works because it's a month. So people can dedicate to it. People can commit for a month. But if it's like a whole year round, I think it's going to be more difficult for people to really commit and to keep those fridges full. And it's just so sad, you know, to if you see someone at a fridge and it's empty, I mean, that's the last thing you want to see, right?
Yeah.
So
it's got to be done properly, right?
Exactly.
And if anyone wants to get involved, how can they do that? What's the first step, Fikra?
So the first step is to go to our page, which is Ramadan Sharing Fridges. That's on Facebook. Yeah, we also have an Instagram page, which is Ramadan Fridges DXB.
And now we can see all those artistically painted fridges. We can also
see everything.
Different locations around town.
All the locations, all the fridges, including the fridge managers. You can see basically everything. And if you like to fill up a fridge, it's really simple. You can click on one of the fridges. You will have all the details. The next step is to go to a grocery shop and buy some all-time favorites like milk, juices, fruits, you know, all the things that I mentioned before. And also, I want to mention that it really doesn't matter how much you put in the fridge.
Mm-hmm.
So even if it's just a pack of biscuits or a bottle of milk, it really doesn't matter. I think all little bits help. And if everyone does a little part, it will make a huge difference. And then the last step is to fill up the fridge. And that's it. It's super simple. And don't forget to involve the children.
Fikra, thank you so much for joining us on Dubai Today. A really, really inspiring initiative, and wishing you all the best for the holy month of Ramadan.
Thank you so much, Helen, for having me. And thank you for all the support. Thank you so much.
Pleasure.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.